Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey class, before we get into this week's episode, very exciting news. Let Me Fix It is nominated for the Webby Award. So thank you for listening and all of your support. You helped us get this nomination, and now we need your help. You can go to the Webby Awards website and vote for us until April 18th. We are under the podcast category for arts and culture, or you can go to our Instagram at FixItPod and hit the link in our bio to vote for us for the Webby Awards. And now on to the episode.
Friend, tell me something that you had to relearn as an adult or a young adult that like you and what you replaced it with, right? Because there's so many things that like we're indoctrinated to. I know indoctrinated is a heavy term, but we're indoctrinated into ways of life, morals, beliefs, notions that we have to unlearn and go, wait, that's not actually how the world works. That's not what I believe. What is something that you can attest to in your experience?
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't say it was... maybe it was in adulthood. I really had to unpack like the respectability politics I had grown up being indoctrinated by, to use your word. You know, I went to Catholic school. I was often the only Black person in my classes in those spaces. And I grew up being told that if you speak a certain way, that you will be more respected, that you will be... you'll get ahead. And I internalized a lot of that stuff because as a kid, when I would be in Black spaces, I often got teased because of the way that I spoke. And
I
so instead of, you know, and look, it's not something, a burden that I carry to this day, but at the time, a lot of times my response was to be like, well, I'm better than them. And like, they are just jealous, you know, and I shout out to my parents because when I would tell them like, hey, the kids are making fun of me, they're like, don't listen to it. You know, kids are going to tease you, whatever. But what it did is it reinforced this idea that the way that I spoke was better and that like I was smarter than them. And like, y'all are the little loser ghetto kids, whatever. And so I really had to unlearn this idea that like, there's no right way to talk. There's no right way to be Black. You're not going to speak or respectability politic your way out of racism or sexism or...
Say that louder for the kids in the back. That's so real, though. That's such real talk.
Yeah. What about you?
I think along the same lines of like the identity portion of things, I'm still unpacking, I'll say, the idea that like being queer and being gay, especially in the patriarchy as a man, is something that you have to hide, is something that is bad, something, and you know, that's why we have pride, because we talk about like, come out and be prideful.
Yeah.
But it's actually adjacent to the respectability things. It's like, there are a couple people that I see in the world sometimes, and I catch myself going, why are you being that? Why are you being that? Whatever fill in the blank that is.
Yeah.
And that's the indoctrination I'm talking about, right? That's me going, no, don't do that. Don't show the world that we're like that. Because I mean, one, it's dangerous, but it also, if you're doing it, that means that like they're gonna see me. And I'm going to be able to identify the ways in which I am like that. And the thing that I'm coming around to, one of the things I'll talk about specifically is like listening to my voice on this podcast, because I edit the podcast.
Yeah.
And one of the things that gifts that it's given me is that like listening to my voice, nobody likes the sound of their voice, right?
Right.
Listening to my voice has made me go, oh, I'm cringing at certain parts. Because I think I sound so gay.
I mean, you do.
Wait, the turn though. She went from, oh my God, wait, what are you talking about? To, well, girl.
Okay, but let me add a caveat. That to your point, you sound gay because you're gay, but also there's nothing wrong with quote unquote sounding gay, right? Like,
exactly.
And I think that's the point that it sounds like you're zeroing in on, right?
100%. And also, like, a comfort with the way I sound, full stop, right?
Yeah.
Which I really am grateful for. And who else am I going to be? You know, I'm not going to be nobody but me, you know?
Okay, now listen, I heard a little sass in that part.
Ooh, wait. No.
Listen. wait.
I hate you for that.
Let me fix it.
Welcome back to Let Me Fix It, the podcast that says, girls, you know you better watch out. I'm Francesca Ramsey. I'm an actress, producer, writer, and former graphic designer.
And I'm DeLon Grant. I'm an actor, a singer, a photographer, and a writer. And class, we opened up about the ways in which we've had to unlearn things from our youth or from our past. Because today we are talking about writer, singer, rapper, and producer who enraptured us all with her miseducation. That's right. Today we are diving into the career of the one and only Miss Lauryn Hill.
Oh, this episode is going to be juicy and heartbreaking. And
let's start by saying, like, our love for her is deep. It is so deep.
Are you kidding me? I have so many deep memories about listening to Lauryn's album and wanting to lock my hair when I saw her and like falling in love with her style and her vibe. And class, I'm sure y'all know Lauryn's story, but we have so much to dig into. For those of you unfamiliar or that need a refresher, Lauryn Hill burst onto the music scene in 1996 as a member of the Fugees. Their second album, The Score, produced a number of hits, including Killing Me Softly and Ready or Not. The album also earned the group 2 Grammys, but it was Lauryn Hill's solo debut that really put her on the map. Released in 1998, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill is widely regarded as one of the best debut solo albums of all time. Okay? With over 12 million albums sold worldwide, it went on to sweep the 1998 Grammys as Lauryn became the first woman to win 5 or more awards in one night, including Grammy for Best New Artist, Best R&B Album, and Album of the Year. The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill also holds the title as the first hip-hop album to win Album of the Year.
Wow, the records, though. The records.
Record-breaking.
Goodness me. Yo, and after her record-breaking night, Lauryn was poised to become a superstar. She'd already gotten high praise for her role in Sister Act 2, which I cannot wait to talk about. But now the movie offers were coming in left and right. Hollywood insiders predicted that Lauryn was poised to follow in the footsteps of chart-topping musicians turned movie stars like Janet Jackson, Will Smith, or Madonna. But after releasing a poorly received MTV Unplugged album, she all but disappeared. Instead, she gained a reputation for being difficult to work with, notorious for firing members of her team and band without warning, and for being chronically late to performances.
So, what happened? How did Miss Hill go from, guys, you know you better watch out, to never putting another album out?
I give it to you. All praise.
I practiced. I was like, do not.
Because she gets caught up on that one.
My brain and the brain hole and the mouth do not talk to each other sometimes. So this week, we are going to unpack this multi-hyphenate's brilliant but short career. And then as usual, we will try our best to fix it. So let's dive in. This is Lauryn Hill. Let me fix it.
So Lauryn Hill was born on May 26, 1975 in East Orange, New Jersey. And from an early age, Lauryn knew she wanted to be in showbiz. At age 13, she performed at Showtime at the Apollo, and her nerves got the best of her. The audience wasn't feeling it either, and they nearly booed her off stage. You remember that, the what do they call the guy with the cane that would pull him off?
He's like a clown or something.
Clown. I forget his name.
If you see this clip, my God, she's so cute. She's so young. It's one of those things where, like, some 13-year-olds have the voice to begin with, and she still had a good voice, but you could just tell she was so nervous, as she should be. She's a kid, but damn, they don't give a fuck.
Yo, black folks do not care. They're like, boo.
Go home and do your homework, little girl.
Right. You should have come up in here if you had the business. But this Apollo appearance did not deter Lauren. At age 17, she booked a small part on the daytime soap As the World Turns. And just a few years later, she booked Sister Act 2 Back in a Habit. Okay, now I'm ready to talk.
Love this movie. We absolutely need to do an episode about it.
We have to. You don't even understand. Like, I was so obsessed with this movie, Fran. In fifth grade, I would go and rent it from Blockbuster because my dad refused to buy me a copy. And I would rent it all the time. Mm-hmm. And then eventually he like set up two VCRs so I could dub it over another. Remember doing that? So I had a bootleg version of, which was like all messed up, of Sister Act 2. I was obsessed.
Well, like I said earlier, I went to Catholic school. So when Sister Act 2 came out, I got the sheet music and we were definitely up in St. Anne's singing Oh Happy Day, doing the Sister Act version in church. And it was scandalous, okay? Because, you know, we're in a Catholic church and we're like, when Jesus won, and everyone's like, what is going on?
A Catholic church at that, but like most bread of all.
Oh, yeah.
So I mean, funny.
Oh my God. Lauren is just so radiant in this movie. Oh. Also, can we shout out the factoid, Cheryl Lee Ralph, who everybody knows from so many movies. She has a lengthy resume, but most recently she's gotten an Emmy for Abbott Elementary. Her playing Lauryn Hill's mom and being like, you will not be a singer.
She's such a villain. She's such a villain in this movie.
And she's good.
And Lauren plays this like kind of like over it, like, you know, not bad girl necessarily, but just like self-assured, confident.
She's a bad girl. She's like, I don't want to be here. This is some bullshit.
There's a scene where they're taking attendance and she goes, sis, let me help you out. Are we all here? Yeah, we're here. And then she goes, Frankie, play the music. Look at me not knowing the movie. Colby and collard greens. So good. One of my favorite things from this movie is her duet with Tanya Blunt. It's the first time I ever heard Eye of the Sparrow.
You take the top and I'll take the bottom. I sing because I'm happy, and I sing because I'm free. His eye is on the sparrow.
The one favorite is, you take the top and I'll take the bottom, which has a different meaning for me now. But
now, when you're recording, when you're editing this and you start cringing about sounding gay, that's the moment I want you to think about.
Well, sounding gay is very different from sounding dirty. That I always laugh at.
Why not both? Duality.
Okay. I'm multitudes, right?
Yes.
While Lauren was shooting Sister Act 2 and killing it, she was also performing and recording music with her high school friends, Praz Michelle and Wyclef Jean, as the Fugees. In 1994, when Lauren was just 18 years old, the Fugees released their debut album, Blunted on Reality, which by industry standards was a flop. We were in fourth grade in 1994. Isn't that crazy?
It is so strange to think about how old Lauren was at the time, because 18 is so young. But when I was looking at her, she was a full ass adult in my eyes. I was like,
absolutely.
It blows my mind that she was 18. But we were, again, fourth grade. We were just kids ourselves. Right. So to go from, you know, being a quote unquote unknown to then thrust into the spotlight, I have a different level of empathy for her experience now that I'm an adult.
Same.
And I can't imagine what that was like. So, you know, like Dylan mentioned, the first album was considered a flop, but maybe it was a blessing in disguise because it helped the Fugees avoid that dreaded sophomore slump, because their second album, The Score, was a smash hit, largely carried by the success of their iconic cover of Roberta Flack's Killing Me Softly. Now I've got a Dylan factoid here that's going to blow your mind. So while Killing Me Softly was made famous by Roberta Flack in 1973, it was first recorded by Lori Lieberman in 1972. But when
it
comes to...
I did not know this.
Now, Dylan, my eyes were bulging out of my head while I was doing this research. Because when it comes to who wrote this hit, there is some drama. And talk about a little bit of foreshadowing. So the song is credited as being written by Charles Fox and Norman Gimbel, the music duo also responsible for writing the theme songs for Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley. Now, according to them, they wrote the song and they shared it with Lori. But Lori claims that she wrote the song on a napkin, actually. And then she said that she brought it to Gimbel. She said, bitch, I remember when I wrote it and what I wrote it on. Okay. That's how you know I really did the shit. She said,
and it was an eyeliner. Okay.
And the napkin was shaped like a flower. Yeah, she knows the whole origin story. So she says she wrote it down and she brought it to Gimbel and Fox because they were working on her album. And it gets messy, of course, because Lori and Gimbel were romantically involved, and the music duo ended up suing her for breach of contract when she decided to part ways with them and completely stalled her career. And to this day, she is still not credited as a writer on the song, even though she claims that she is the original author. Isn't that nuts?
Yo, the music industry has always been foul. The music industry has always been abusive and foul and predatory.
Especially to young women. I think she was like in her early 20s at the time. And like they had a deal where they were being asked to kind of like shepherd artists and like package them, where like, you know, they had kind of been set up to work together. And so there's just all these discrepancies about who it was. And look, you know, songwriting is a collaborative process. In my mind, I'm like, just give the girl some credit. Just give her some credit.
And let that be the end of it.
And just let it be the end of it. But they said, no, we taking your ass to court. So fast forward to Roberta Flack. She hears Lori's version of her song, listen to this detail, on a tape while flying from L.A. to New York. Got her tape player. Listen to some tapes.
Well, you did say the tapes are coming back, Fran. So
seriously. And she decided that she wanted to record her own version. She spent about 3 months in the studio working on the song, making adjustments to the chord structure and cadence until it was just right. Her rendition went on to win Record of the Year, Song of the Year, and Best Female Pop Vocal at the 1974 Grammys.
What's so crazy is this is such great history, because when I first heard Killing Me Softly on The Score with the Fugees, I was like, these people are geniuses. This is an amazing song.
It's incredible.
And then I got corrected and they were like, no, this is a Roberta Flack song. And I was like, oh, okay. And just in the research for this episode, now you're telling me it's maybe three other people's songs. So like the controversy is so deep.
You know, the thing is too, that's interesting about it is a good song is a good song. It's rare that a cover outshines or outperforms the original. It happens every once in a while. Like you think about Whitney Houston singing, I Will Always Love You. That's not the original. You know what I mean? Dolly Parton's got the original. They're both very good, but every once in a while, the cover outperforms. So this is really interesting that this song has had multiple lives and has been successful in the number of different genres every time. Yeah. And to your point, the Fugees version it's incredible. I mean, it's just so special and different.
It's so good. And I think this is where I would argue, like, this is where Lauren kind of like melded a lot of hip hop and R&B and neo soul on The Score, on that album, because I would argue, and this is not up for debate, even though I said I'm arguing, that Killing Me Softly and Ready or Not are two of the best bridges in popular music, in my opinion.
Oh,
right? Like,
incredible.
And Lauren just singing, just oohing and aahing, and I'm like, I live for it. And you can't run away from these stars I got, baby.
You can't run away from these stars I got, baby. Hey, baby, 'cause I got a lot,
the jam, man.
Oh, yeah. I mean, her voice is so special and iconic and sultry. And yeah, I mean, it's a great cover, but the backstory is bonkers.
A mess. So, like Fran was saying, the Fugees cover of Killing Me Softly is a huge hit. It goes on to win a Grammy for Best R&B Performance by a Duo or Group with Vocal. After the success of the score, Wyclef starts recording a solo project with the blessing of Pras and Lauren. But when Lauren started writing her own music, she felt like Wyclef paid her dust and like nothing. According to Pras, he says, "I remember when Pepsi wanted her for a commercial and they were like, all we want is you. We don't need those other two cats." She said, "Without them, I'm not doing it." Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things she didn't do because of the group. Then when she goes to work on her music, she doesn't have the support, and that can have an effect mentally. When you feel like the ones you stuck your neck out for ain't doing the same for you, it brings a certain animosity and bitterness. I hear that. Because that's money.
And we've talked about this a few different times. It's like when you're in a group, especially if there is a female member of the group, the powers that be are like, you're the star. Whether it's No Doubt and Gwen Stefani, whether, you know, you're looking at the Supremes or Destiny's Child, right? Like, it's that
Gladys
same
Knight and the Pips.
Gladys Knight and the Pips. Where are the Pips? Who are the Pips? What are they doing?
Who are the Pips? Who are the Pips? I'm sorry, Pips.
What is a Pip?
I hope y'all are doing well, but we don't know who y'all are.
Right. And it sucks because it doesn't mean that everybody's not talented. I would argue that it's like the narrow-mindedness of the entertainment industry where they're like, only one, because look, it's in sync, right? Justin and JC. They decide, oh, it has to be Justin. And it's like, well, that's not really fair. And so in this instance, Lauren was being poised as the breakout and she said, nah, we a group. And Wyclef didn't even like respect her for that.
That's so foul. Listen, the Koreans have really changed the game because
with
they said we have 26 members.
All
yes,
of
with
y'all.
K-pop. We have 26 members and one of y'all fuck up. We gonna switch you out.
We'll just get
and put another
no one,
one
will
in.
Miss you because no one knows your name.
No one knows who you are. You are the Pips, okay?
26 Pips. Rumor is that it was always competitive between Wyclef and Lauren, and it was made messier by the fact that the two were secretly romantically involved, even after... Now, what? This always happens.
Why is this always... I guess close proximity, like, you know. But, I mean, in that respect, you and I should be fucking...
Can you imagine? Let me fix it. It all fell apart when Francesca and DeLong started fucking. That's what it just...
People will be like, what?
You could hear the whole tone of the podcast change. I don't know. I would think maybe, you know what it reminds me of? A lot of times, like, directors and their lead actress fall in love. Mm-hmm. I think it's like doing collaborative artistic stuff and you're writing about feelings. You're spending all this like time together. Looking into
you end
other's...
up sharing a lot of stuff, a lot of personal things. They see you.
Yes,
yeah, it happens.
You're talking about feelings and stuff. So, like I said, the two of them were romantically involved, even when Wyclef was dating somebody else and eventually ended up getting married to her. And this, of course, just was the start of Lauren's romantic troubles. In 96, Lauren gets herself in the middle of a love triangle when she's dating Rohan Marley, Bob Marley's son, and Wyclef at the same time. And when she gets pregnant, everybody is buzzing because they're like, whose baby is it? It's giving Maury.
Oh, totally.
I mean, it's just so messy. I mean, listen, it gave us a great album. So thank you,
Lauren. It really did. Yeah, thank you for your struggles, girl.
Thank you for your service, girl. As much as Lauren wanted the baby to be Wyclef's, hoping that maybe it would force him to commit, it was not. And in 1997, she gives birth to Zion Marley. You might know a song to Zion.
Now the joy of my world is in Zion.
So shortly after, Lauren begins calling Rohan her husband, but it turns out he was already married.
Yo, the plot I can't even say it thickens. I think it's just get más sucia, more dirty.
Yo, okay? the plot is thicker than a bowl of oatmeal, just chunky.
And it's undercooked oatmeal at that. Oh,
and again, those love troubles go on to become the inspiration for many of the songs on this classic award-winning album.
Oh, God. So when it was time for Lauren to record her solo album, she was less interested in being a star than she was proving herself better than Wyclef. She had a chip on her shoulder, or several chips, okay? Mm-hmm. She just wanted to get out from under his shadow. He was being touted as a musical genius after the success of The Score, but apparently she felt like she should be seen as a musical genius. So, when it came time to record her album, she was insistent that she was given sole credit as a writer, artist, and producer on the album, despite working with a handful of musicians and producers in the studio, including a musical group named Newark. Bookmark that. Mm-hmm. So Columbia Records suggested bringing in an outside producer to help her, including RZA from the Wu-Tang Clan. But Lauren insisted that she could handle it. Later on, Wyclef comes back and he wants to help her with the album, but he didn't exactly offer to help. He tried to strong arm her into producing the entire thing, which just pissed Lauren off even more.
Ugh, like it, when you hear it back, you can see all of the moments where it was like, this was the time to do this the right way and not give yourself drama later on. Because, like, look, Wyclef is a very talented producer. If he hadn't paid her dust and maybe had just collaborated with her from the jump, maybe, you know, things wouldn't have gone so poorly as they did later on. And even right. if he maybe hadn't been such a jerk to her, maybe she wouldn't have been like, I need soul writing producer credits. I need soul, like, all the soul credits, when she knew she was technically working with other musicians.
Well, and here's the thing. Like, we talk about her being so young. I don't know. Let's assume Wyclef was the same age. But despite that, like, when you have people that you trust that are, for lack of a better phrase, betraying you or betraying your trust or taking advantage of you, the thing is to learn from those mistakes, to not trust those people and not trust other people. So to your point, it's like she was influenced by those experiences and being like, yo, I'm a woman and nobody's protecting me. So I need to protect myself because I'm surrounded by all these dudes trying to take. And I really understand that, like, she put up a wall, you know, to try to protect herself and get what was hers.
It totally makes sense in hindsight. So The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill comes out in 1998 and, of course, was a massive success. It debuted at number one on the Billboard 200 chart, selling over 422,000 copies in its first week, breaking the then record for first week sales by a female artist. Now, remember, Lauryn was only 23 years old when this happened. Like, that is...
That makes me feel not only old, but like completely unaccomplished.
I know. I mean, it's one of those things where, like, look, everybody's journey is everyone's journey. And like, not to poo-poo her success or all the things that she accomplished, but I would argue that sometimes when fame happens to you that young, it really can mess with your head. And that's something that she talks about.
I mean, we could list 10 people right now.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, I saw this thing, and I think I mentioned it to you, where there's like this theory that the age you become famous is like where you become crystallized, because like everybody treats you differently. It's like you can't go back. There's no normal. You cannot flip a switch and just, you know, be anonymous ever. You are famous. There's like the life before you were famous, and then there's fame. So for Lauren, it was pretty instantaneous. Doo-Wop, That Thing was her first single. Guys, you know you better. Watch out. Some girls are only about that thing. Do you remember when the song came out, DeLon?
I mean, this is when MTV still played music videos, and I was blown away by I think I might even have, like, texted or called, or be in text by then, like, called in to, what was it called?
For TRL?
TRL to like try to get them to play it. And I also put it right high on my Christmas list, which was exactly what I got. I got the album for Christmas. Thanks, Mom.
Oh my God.
I do remember it. It was so influential to me.
Oh my God. I remember it too, because my dance teacher, shout out to Mr. Lewis, was in the music video. And so we all watched the video at school. I was going to School of the Arts. And we all got around the TV. We had one of those big ass TVs that was on a rolly cart. Do you remember that? They roll that cart into class. You're like, yes, we're watching a movie. They rolled that cart in there. And we watched. He is like a light skinned black guy. He's bald and he's got a fedora down in his, like, over his eyes, and he's doing this like shoulder shimmy. And we were honestly, Dawn, you couldn't tell me shit. I was famous. I might as well have been in the music video.
Famous adjacent.
The video was so black.
Yes.
It was so black. It's so beautiful. It was so Harlem.
And, it was like it was, shot in Harlem. Yeah, right?
It was
and the thing
gorgeous.
That I love about, like, the thing that I think critics talk about is, like, you know, we talked about it earlier, her melding of hip-hop, R&B, mm-hmm. and neo-soul. But she also, like, that gave us something to look at and go, yo, this is new and different and us. It is ours. And we felt so seen. You know, what are some of your other tracks from
God. I mean, there's so many good songs on this album. Everything Is Everything is
everything.
We about to get
Zion was one of my favorite. How
gorgeous.
Beautiful and nothing more. That was my jam.
I mean, and what was so beautiful about this album is she was really pouring her heart and soul in these songs. She's talking about motherhood, and Zion is about, should I have this baby? I mean, people were telling her, she's early in her career, right? And the people around her are going, do not have a baby. This is going to screw up your career. And she's deciding, do I want to do this? But also to that same point on the unlearning tip, doo-wop is a little pick-me-ish. You know, she's talking about hair we use by Europeans, nails done by Koreans. She's being a little judgmental, you know? But that was her perspective.
Well, and I've always seen that as, like, I guess not necessarily an indictment on those people, but I think I often have thought, like, in Black communities, there are stores, liquor stores, hair stores, nail salons.
Yeah.
And they tend to be owned by people of Asian descent.
Yeah.
And I've never understood why Black people don't own those. It's mind-boggling
to me. That's a whole nother episode. But, like, look,
absolutely.
Racism is a big part of it. If you can't get a loan, if you don't have, you know, if you don't have the financial literacy, because maybe your parents don't have access to those things, and or you are renting or attempting to buy property from somebody who is, you know, people come into these Black neighborhoods and they buy up businesses and they make it impossible for us to own capital where we live, right? And or, like, when we talked about white flight, when we do get a hold of something, everybody's like, we gotta go.
right. And I think that's what she, in my mind, that's what she was saying. And I was like, oh, wow. Hailed them by Koreans. And I was like, oh, wow. I mean, it is judgy. Don't get me wrong. It's judgy.
And I think you're correct, because, like, she does talk about the fact, like, I don't remember the exact words, but she says something about, like, Lauren is only human.
Showing off your ass because you're thinking it's a trend, girlfriend. Let me break it down for you again. You know I only say it because I'm truly genuine. Don't be a hard rock when you really are a gem, baby girl. Respect is just a minimum. You still defending them now.
Because she starts by talking about what women need to do and then what men need to do. And so you're right. I think it's that multi-layered thing. And maybe that's, you know, ironically what the miseducation is about, right? That, like,
exactly.
These are things that I've ingested and that I believed and that I've had to figure out for myself. And again, I think that that's why this album is so brilliant and it resonated with so many people.
Yeah, it just it definitely pushes on cultural norms in the community. Again, she's speaking to us, which I think is so revolutionary at the time, as speaking to a specific generation of people, you know.
Yeah.
One of the things I also wanted to bring up in terms of covers that I didn't know were covers. The first time I ever heard You're Just Too Good to Be True, which is originally by Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, was on this album.
You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off of you. You be like heaven to touch. I wanna hold you so much.
At long last, love has arrived. And I thank God I'm alive. You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off you.
And I realize now, doing this episode, that it's because she's from New Jersey, as are Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. I know that because I was in Jersey Boys, the Broadway musical, on tour.
I know. I was like, is he going to mention Jersey Boys?
What's really crazy is that I didn't realize it was a cover until I sat down and watched Jersey Boys. And I was like,
I know this song.
I know this song. I know it a different version. So I think it's also an homage to her being from New Jersey and Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons being from New Jersey. But it's one of the things I was like, oh, this is a cute little factoid.
But also it's like doo-wop, right? It's like all of those themes of like old and new and just like how you can put your own spin on things. And it's just, again, it's truly such a brilliant debut.
Yeah, one of the things on the album that I think is really cool, factoid alert, is that the album's teacher and student interludes were recorded in Lauryn Hill's living room in New Jersey. They feature poet Roz Baraka as the teacher. Roz is also happens to be the current mayor of Newark, New Jersey.
Incredible.
Okay. Talk, you know, not a big deal.
Like,
wow.
Yo, your resume is like incredible, dude.
Crazy. So the conversations are completely improvised. Lauren just asked Baraka to talk to the children about the concept of love. He's a poet, okay, y'all? And as is his father. Here's a factoid on a factoid. So Roz is the son of another famous Black creative, Amiri Baraka, who is best known as a writer and a poet laureate of New Jersey around the same time Lauren's album was blowing up. So just like legacy on legacy.
Surrounded by Black excellence and then incorporating into the album. It's so brilliant.
Thank you for the gift. Only one, but thank you for the gift. So The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill was among the most acclaimed albums of 1998, and to this day, it tops countless best album lists from the likes of Rolling Stone, the Smithsonian, the Library of Congress, and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The album's massive success is often credited to bringing hip-hop, neo-soul into the mainstream. At the 41st Annual Grammy Awards, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill went on to win 5 of its 10 Grammy nominations, thus making Lauryn Hill the first woman to receive that many nominations and awards in one night. I cannot believe this information. Like, she really was sitting on top of the world.
I put a photo in the doc of her holding all 5 of her awards. And I put this photo in here because now we've seen everybody do this pose. Adele, Beyonce. But Lauren was the first. She said, I gotta figure out how to hold all these motherfuckers because I am sweeping this bitch.
And she's so stunning.
Oh my God, she's so freaking beautiful. So the album went certified 5 times platinum and holds the record as one of the fastest selling albums to achieve this milestone. By August 99, it had sold 10 million copies worldwide. And in April 2002, Columbia said that the album had sold 12 million copies worldwide. By 2009, its global sales were reported to be 19 million copies. Every year, the sales are just doubling. This is also just an era where you needed to buy an album.
You needed to buy a CD. Yep.
You wanted to have a copy. You wanted to have multiple copies. One for your car, one for your home.
Okay.
You know, like you needed to have them stacked up. The album held the record for longest charting debut album of a female rapper on the Billboard 200 at 91 weeks. And it held that record, this is interesting, for 21 years before being surpassed by Cardi B's Invasion of Privacy in 2018, which is a great album. It still holds up. I listened to it the other day in my car and I was fucking bopping.
Wait, Invasion of Privacy or Cardi B's?
Cardi B's Invasion of Privacy. It's good.
You know, I really only know some songs off of it. Now I'm gonna listen to it tonight.
I will say she's not comparable to Lauryn Hill. And it is one of those things where, like, numbers aren't everything. And today, sure, we're not just counting record sales, we're counting streams also. So again, the numbers are very different in that respect. But I went back and listened to it because I was like, damn, Cardi has not put out another album. She's put out some singles. But I listened to Invasion of Privacy. It's really good. Give it a listen if you haven't, Dylan. In 2021, Miseducation of Lauryn Hill was diamond certified by the RIAA, which led to earning the Guinness Book World Record for the first female rapper to earn such status.
The records just keep going. After the actual album release, she performed on SNL and the Billboard Music Awards before embarking on a sold-out world tour. All of Lauryn's hard work had paid off, and she had achieved her great dream of becoming a global superstar, recognized as that musical genius she wanted to be, finally. But the high wouldn't last that long. That same year, the members of that group, Newark, who she recorded with, the band who was in the studio with her, filed a lawsuit against Lauryn. Newark claimed that she used their songs and production skills, but failed to properly credit them for their work. The suit was eventually settled out of court in 2001 for a reported $5 million. But that wouldn't be the last time Lauryn had some legal battles.
Oh, my. Can you imagine having such a huge success and then we're going to sue
you? Here's what I don't get. They sued her for the credit part, but she must have paid them,
right? Oh, yeah. I'm pretty sure. Yeah, I'm sure they were paid. Yeah.
Or Columbia paid them.
Yeah, but if you're not credited, you don't get royalties. Like,
exactly.
You get I think they call them like points. There's a certain number that you get based on how much you contributed. And that's why, you know, you may have seen some of these viral conversations happening recently about songwriters being upset when musicians come in and they say, I changed one word and now I want this many points. And then the songwriter's like, yeah, but I actually did all of this work and now I'm making less money on a hit. Or they don't even know how many points they're getting. You know, the song goes off, they don't know who it's going to be recorded by. The song comes out, it's a huge hit, and the songwriter's going, I have not received any money and I wrote that. And they go, oh no, they came in and they changed X, Y, and Z, and now you're getting this much money instead of this much.
The music industry is thievery. It is absolute thievery.
It really is. Now, this is something that really shocked me because I love Lauryn Hill as an actress, even though I really only know her run in Sister Act 2. I didn't know that she had done, you know, a soap opera prior to that. After the success of her debut album, she was getting movie offers thrown at her left and right, but she kept turning them down. Sources say she was offered a role in Charlie's Angels that then went to Lucy Liu. Wow. She also met with Matt Damon about being in The Bourne Identity. I would have loved to fucking see her in an action movie.
In The Bourne Identity. Oh my God. She would have been the German lady's part, maybe.
Oh, like, I don't know who that is.
Playing opposite him. Oh, yo, I love The Bourne Identity, though. You know, I have my issues with Matt Damon and his stance on homosexuality.
Oh, but what?
He ruined it.
I didn't know about that.
He came out the cuff and said some things.
But I knew he has said some stuff about diversity. Yeah, no, that's a white man who should keep his mouth shut. So maybe that's why Lauryn was like, you know what? I got a vibe about you.
She can smell a coffee, okay?
I'm going to say no. But she also met with Brad Pitt about being in The Mexican. She was also up for possibly being in The Matrix trilogy. She was offered a part in the last two films. She was also supposedly offered the lead role in A Star Is Born, the remake. Which, of course, we know went to Lady Gaga, but like, I mean, listen, and that was Gaga's part, and she did a great job. But like, it's wild to hear about these big movies that could have been totally different starring Lauryn Hill. She was also offered the part of Dina in Dreamgirls.
I did know that before it went to Beyonce. I did know that. And I'm like, I mean, and I wonder too, this is trying to get into her brain and kind of editorializing a little bit, but I wonder if she like had fear around it, or she's like, "Not that's not what I do," and I wouldn't know how to do that or whatever.
I don't know. I think that feels plausible to me. But the thing is, on that tip, she did start trying to work in some movies. She was developing a biography of Bob Marley with plans to play his wife. She was also producing a rom-com that was going to be about soul food, which she was going to star in. She also did accept the role in the highly anticipated adaptation of Toni Morrison's Beloved, but dropped out when she became pregnant. Now, I don't know that that movie has ever materialized. It's been in development for an eternity. They've been trying to make it into a movie. They did do a TV show version.
I was going to say, wasn't Oprah starring in the TV show?
No, the TV show was on Hulu. I don't know if it was maybe.
They did one movie called Beloved, and Oprah was in it. I remember that. Oh, it was like scary.
Oh, yeah, yes, you were correct. They did do a movie version. Yeah, so Lauren had some projects lined up that it sounded like she was ready to be in, and they just didn't materialize. But you're correct. It does seem like maybe fear was motivating this. Or, I mean, to be fair, maybe she just was like, that's not what I want to do. I don't want to be in action movies.
That's not what I want to do. I work when I want to work, and she has a family. So after finishing her successful Sold Out World tour, Lauren returned back to the States as a different woman. She's now a young mother of two and an international superstar. She couldn't run to the grocery store anymore in sweatpants. She had to have a full-on beat hair and makeup. Ooh. So the pressures of newfound fame really started to weigh on her. She was really unhappy in a relationship with Rohan and was still reeling from the embarrassment of the lawsuit and supporting multiple members of her family financially, in addition to having some of them on her staff. And keep in mind, this woman is 25 or 26 years old at this time. She's a kid.
Yeah.
Her brain's not fully developed, okay?
That is so, so much to deal with. And a lot of the stuff that I was reading about this time in her life was like the shell shock of, oh, I'm not a normal quote unquote person anymore.
Yeah.
So at this time, she gets connected with a man who calls himself Brother Anthony, and they become attached at the hip, and he starts serving as a spiritual advisor of sorts. They're doing Bible study multiple days a week. And again, hindsight is 20/20, but it's like you're going through this really difficult time. Your whole world is being rocked. And now here comes a spiritual advisor who's going to help turn things around for you. And most of the people in Lauren's camp agreed that this dude was sketchy and largely responsible for her pulling away from the world. Some allege that he was brainwashing Lauren. And in a 2003 article for Rolling Stone, her former bandmate Praz is quoted as saying, "Brother Anthony was definitely on some shit. I had a tape of his teaching. That shit is ill. Fucked me up. I can't really explain it. It was some weird shit, man. It was real cult shit. He was saying, give up all your money. I don't know if that meant give it to me or whatever, but the tape," he said, "money doesn't mean anything."
Now you say that to a rich person. Come on now.
Is there a troop of these people that just get connected with rich people? Because a lot of rich people have spiritual advisors. How do I become somebody's advisor?
I might get pushback for saying this, but religion does this so well. Religion convinces people to tithe and give all kinds of money Religion convinced the United States to give it tax exemptions like crazy. And those are my politics. But to your point, Fran, I think that these people become susceptible because we're just talking about, you're kind of in your own silo, in your own world, with your own family. And like, if she's a young mother, and I can imagine all these people are asking for things. If there's someone that's going to give her something and trying to give her like a teaching, something that stabilizes her and grounds her, I can imagine that she's like, in the desert and she's just coming for a cup of water, you know?
Yeah, you're so right. Especially when you think about like how lonely fame can be. And now you have somebody who's like, I'll be there for you and you can trust me. And like, you start spending a lot of time with them. And, it's that thing of like, everything seems great and you want to believe that this person is in your corner, that you might not be able to see that they're taking advantage of you.
It's so true. So in July 2001, while pregnant with her third child, Lauren recorded an episode of MTV Unplugged. She was reportedly sick, but insisted on taping it anyway and accompanying herself on the guitar. But she really didn't play the guitar.
Yeah.
She'd only been playing for a few months at the time, which, listen, I'm all about I'm all about, like, you know, do your art, but girl, you got to be ready. You got to be ready, especially if doing it live on Unplugged.
That was a choice.
The album is rough and unfocused. It sort of feels like she, like, got some friends together and, like, let's jam, friends, yeah. You know? Her voice is scratchy and raspy because she was sick, evidently, and she's kind of playing the same chords and doing the same strumming pattern, so a lot of the sound kind of feels the same. The Unplugged album only sold 470,000 copies, which may sound like a lot, but it just didn't meet the expectation of what her first album did, which it sucks to say that, because, like, you shouldn't, your continued creations or art or production should not be based on what you created before,
yeah.
But we were all anticipating it. The world was like, give me more.
Yeah.
And this one kind of flopped.
Yeah. And I put this note in the doc because 470,000 albums sold is a lot, but it's interesting when you think about at the time it was seen as a flop. Today, you know, you've got artists that are considered, you know, the best selling artist of the year, and they're selling 500,000, 300,000 copies. Again, the landscape is just so different because people don't buy albums anymore, and so much is done on streaming. So again, it's that wild thing of like 470,000 is still a lot of albums, but to your point, the expectation was just set so high after that debut that they just didn't measure up. So in the years following the Unplugged album, Lauren was rumored to be working on a new studio album, but nothing ever materialized. She reunited briefly with the Fugees for a tour in 2005, but the tour fell apart, with Praz and Wyclef blaming Lauren. Supposedly, she was demanding that everyone call her Miss Hill, including her bandmates.
Okay.
She also, for a short time, was asking to be called Empress. I don't know what that's about. And here is where it happens. She started being late to things. When it came to working on the album, there were all sorts of stories flying around about bringing musicians in and keeping them waiting for days at a time and never coming to the studio. And on the rare chance that you did get invited to the studio, Lauren was supposedly demanding that people sign papers to give her full credit for the writing sessions before a note had even been played.
That's crazy, man. That's unrealistic.
Yeah. And here's the thing. Part of me is like, well, she's probably thinking about what happened before, right? She's like, fucked me up. Who knows? Maybe there was a handshake. And in her mind, she was like, we're good to go. But you don't have it in writing.
You'll get sued for $5 million.
Exactly. So then there's, of course, the problem of getting Lauren to the studio. Columbia reportedly had a studio built for her inside her Miami apartment because she was so notorious for refusing to just go a few miles down the street to record elsewhere. In recent years, she's become what some might call a religious fanatic, sometimes speaking entirely in Bible verses. And when musicians have reportedly asked her to pay for the work that they've done, she said things like, do it for God, aka do it for free.
And it also feels like God is me. Do it for me. Crazy. Yeah. So it turns out Lauren wasn't just cutting quarters when it came to paying and crediting her musical collaborators. In June 2012, she pled guilty to tax evasion, owing roughly $2.3 million in back, state, and federal taxes. Despite her commercial success, Hill told courts that most of the money she'd made from her music had gone to other people. She insisted she planned on paying her taxes. She just hadn't gotten around to it yet.
I owe you.
She's like, no, I was coming.
I owe you.
This is a messy, messy, messy headline. So a CNN article about her sentencing was titled Tax Education of Lauren Hill, Prison. Y'all are foul. It's cute, but it's foul.
I mean, it was clever, but that is harsh. Somebody at CNN was like, I'm gonna drop this one. Like, they were so happy.
So good. So unfortunately, Lauren was sentenced to 3 months in prison and followed by house arrest and probation. The day she was released from prison, she released a song on her SoundCloud called Consumerism, which is basically 5 minutes of her listing nouns that end in ism. And it's just unbelievably heartbreaking because it's unfocused. And it's heartbreaking because, like, I just, like, I want, after coming out of prison, I want her to have a success story. I want her to drop an album and be like, I went through some shit. Here it is. You know, talk about it.
I'm also like, did she record this before she went into prison? And she was like, let's, you know, drop it on the day I get out. I'm confused about the timeline.
Along the lines of timeline, I think she should have let this marinate. I think she should have let it sit there for a minute, come back in 2-3 days, weeks, months, and go, you know what? Let's cut this shit up and figure out another way.
The song is weird.
Yeah, consumerism's running through them like a tumor in them. Ageism, sexism, racism, chauvinism. Capitalism running through them like the rumor business. Separatism, skepticism, modernism, atheism. Television running through them like an organism. Mechanism, despotism, poison in the ecosystem. Satanism running through them like a politician. Hedonism, hypocrisy, nihilism, narcissism.
In a 2018 interview with Houston radio station 97.9 The Box, Grammy-winning jazz pianist, songwriter, producer Robert Glasper called Lauren all the way out on the show. He recounted being part of her backing band for a show that she was doing in 2008. The set was only supposed to be 20 minutes, but Lauren had the band rehearsing for 10 hours a day.
Yo,
for a week.
That's crazy.
Here's a quote from the interview. Every day, she comes in and changes the show, changes what she wants to do completely. The last rehearsal, she doesn't show up. Her manager comes in and says, Lauren's not really feeling the way you guys have been learning the music, so we're going to cut your pay in half. The last rehearsal, the day before the show, we're going to cut your pay in half. So first of all, we weren't getting paid that much anyway, but understand she's getting $500,000. So seriously, you're going to take these five musicians and cut their pay in half? This interview, he is in this interview.
I understand. Like, here's the thing. As a musician, as somebody who was taken advantage of, the idea that you are going to take advantage of other people is crazy. If nothing else, it's one thing to say, hey, Fran, I don't like how you're playing that. Thank you so much. It's been so real. We got another person to come in and I'm going to pay you for your time. But to say you're not playing it the way I want you to play it and cut your pay in half and still expect you to play it in some kind of way.
And also to not show up to rehearsals. It's disrespectful.
Right. That part.
It's really wild. Reportedly, the band was also told not to look at Lauryn Hill, not to look her in the eye, and also to only call her Miss Hill.
I'm into Robert Glasper because this is not the first time Robert Glasper was mentioned on our podcast.
Correct.
We mentioned Robert Glasper in our Bad Apologies episode when Chris Brown called him out on Twitter for winning a Grammy over him.
Yeah.
And I'll say this. Robert Glasper kept his mouth shut because Fran and DeLon came to his rescue, okay? But it's just crazy, too, that he is a musician in his own right, Grammy Award winning, so accomplished. And not for nothing, but like other Black musicians aren't trying to prop up other Black musicians and help them out, right?
Yeah, well, and that's why the interview with him is so heartbreaking to listen to. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. It's a long interview, but he's revved up. You know, you can tell he's been marinating on this for a long time and just need to speak his truth. And you can feel the pain in it, right? It's like he doesn't want this to be true.
So rough. So Lauren has tried to explain her lateness as a symptom of her perfectionism. In a 2018 Medium article, she wrote, "Me being late to shows isn't because I don't respect my fans or their time, but the contrary. It can be argued I care too much and insist on things being right. I like to switch up my show regularly, change arrangements, add new songs, etc. This often leads to long sound checks, which leads to the doors opening late, which leads to the show getting a late start. This element of perfectionism is about wanting the audience to experience the very best and most authentic experience they can from what I do. Girl, then show up earlier if you need all that damn time. That makes no sense to me."
I saw her in 2015 at Afropunk. She was 2 hours late, and I ended up leaving early because I was just like, I don't want her to ruin the image I have of her in my mind. It's just such a bummer because you can't deny how talented she is, but all of this stuff has seemed to have gotten in the way of her having the successful career that she absolutely deserved. So in September 2023, Lauryn Hill announced a tour with the Fugees in celebration of the 25th anniversary of her debut album. But the tour was plagued by late start times, along with strained vocals and then viral clips of these slowed down and sped up renditions of everyone's favorite songs. During one show, Lauren paused the concert and she went on this rant about her chronic lateness. She says, "Y'all are lucky I made it to this blood rot stage every night. I leave my soul on the stage." Delon, the God complex is really jumping out at me.
Y'all are lucky?
Y'all are lucky. Like, no, we paid for this. We
paid for it.
You're not doing me a favor. I took the night off to
come here.
Literally, I got a babysitter.
Like, you know what I'm saying?
You know what I mean?
When the album sold so many records, and no one showed up and said, "Hey, would you like to make another one?" So I went around the world, and I played the same album over and over and over.
No one wanted you to make another album? Ma'am, what are you talking about?
They built a studio in your Miami apartment for a second album, girl.
But she does sound hurt. She sounds upset. Yes. She sounds defensive. She's going through something. I don't know what she's going through, but that was something you needed to take care of before you got to stage.
Thank you.
We would like to hear you play the music.
Well, and wouldn't that help her? Like, the idea that we would go to the concert and be like, "You know what, Lauren tore it up." Mm-hmm. Like, even if the songs were sped up or slowed down, like, she showed up on time, she killed it, I had a great time.
Yes.
I'm so glad she's back. The internet would go ablaze with that.
We love a comeback story, and the sad part is the mic drop moment backfired because they announced that the tour was being postponed in November 2023, just 2 months after the tour had began. They said that they're coming back this year, and I hope that this time off has helped her get it together. Delon, I'm curious, why do you think we have never gotten another studio album from Lauryn Hill?
You know, I mean, I think it might be a lot of things, but I think we get some insight from something she said, actually. Mm. So back in 2000, she was talking to a bunch of high school students, and she was asked a question about something else, and she kind of just launches into this thing about a second album.
"I'm not in the studio right now, and everybody in my world thinks I'm crazy. What's going on? You need another album out. You know, the time is running out. You have a window, a certain window to make music." And for a little while, I listened to that. And I was like in the studio working real hard, trying to get it done. And, you know, music was created. Definitely music that I think people will appreciate, but it wasn't my best. And it wasn't my best because there was no substance. And there was no substance because there was no experience. I'd gone from the studio to the stage, back into the studio again. And the only reason why The Miseducation was the album it was because of a myriad of experiences that took place before the production part, before the creation. So what I realized is, you know what? I can't create and not live. I can't be in this vacuum of, you know, of creativity, creativity, creativity without life.
And she goes on to talk about peaks and valleys and mastership and study. And it's really a profound thing to be 25 years old and say and have that level of reflection.
Yeah.
But I think it's like she was at this height, this apex. And so anything that she did had to match that. And so anything she did fell short for her and maybe fell short for other people. And so I think that might be why. It's just kind of that imposter syndrome. But like, she's looking at herself and being like, "I can't do that again. I'm supposed to do that again."
Yeah. I mean, this idea of the sophomore slump, I mentioned it earlier. It's this idea of a sophomore failing to live up to the relatively high standards that occurred during their freshman year. It's commonly used to refer to an apathy in students. You also hear it used with athletes and musicians. And Delon, I think you hit the nail on the head. All of that success, in a way, kind of makes you afraid of, like, am I going to be able to live up to what I did before? And on the one hand, it's heartbreaking, but it's also like, man, that's what the album should have been. Like, that's what I want to hear. I want to hear you wrestling with it. To her point about, you know, living in a vacuum and whatever, I have heard a number of musicians say this. I think when we talked about Andre 3000, he said, like, what can I rap about? Like, I'm in my 50s and I'm fucking rich, right? And so it is hard when you become famous, I can imagine, to like translate those experiences into a way that normal people can understand. But I think everybody understands fear of failure, and everybody understands like wanting to be successful, you know, and being afraid. Like, that's what I wanted to hear her write about, you know?
Yeah, I totally hear you on that. And I also think like fail. Allow yourself to fail. Put the album out and allow it to fucking fail, because that is the life that she's talking about in that quote. Not only that, like art is very subjective. There would be people who would love the fucking album just because it's her album.
Yeah.
Just because it's her. Because there are stands out there that like, I don't care. You know?
I think she lost the opportunity.
I think she really lost the opportunity. I also would add, the voice we've talked about is like, has really been gone through some stuff. And so I think that like the insecurity of like not having the gift as much anymore might be, you know, might be a stalling factor as well.
Yeah, it really might be. And I would be curious to know, like, if she's gotten vocal training, if she's worked with someone. You know, that is, vocal problems plague a lot of singers. Adele is an example of somebody who has a phenomenal voice, but the training does not necessarily match the talent. And those two things got to go hand in hand. You got to treat
the
instrument.
She's had multiple surgeries. Yeah.
And she's too young to have had all those surgeries, right? You need to be that on that Celine Dion vocal rest. No talking, no smoke. You know, staying away from orange juice or whatever it is you're not supposed to be drinking. All right, class, now that we've dug into Lauryn Hill's career, it's time for us to fix it. But first, let's take a quick break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And we are back. Dahlan, are you okay with me going first?
Absolutely.
All right, so my fix for Lauryn Hill, I want a tell-all book. And guess what, Lauryn? Mm. You can have a ghostwriter and still get all the credit.
Britney did it.
and it was a success, and it was all over the New York Times, broke all these records. Lauryn has a story to tell. And the beauty of working with a ghostwriter is she can have somebody who literally just follows her around for a year with like a tape recorder. The book writing process is lengthy. She don't have to show up anywhere at a specific time. She can literally just tell her stories to this ghostwriter, and they can craft an amazing story, like learning about her childhood, and like, what was that first audition like? What was it like when she booked Sister Act 2? You know, she went to college for a little bit while she was still in the Fugees. And like, what was that like? And then even like the love triangle shit with Marley.
What a mess.
I mean, all of that stuff is fascinating. So I would really love a book from her. The thing that I was thinking about, she really missed the boat on like the natural hair care thing. She, I think, would have really done well if she had done something with locks, because nobody else had locks. You know, like now we've got Chloe and Halle, for example. But like, I remember seeing Lauryn Hill and being like, holy shit, I didn't know natural hair could look like that. So in that same vein, I would love fashion moment from her, some accessories. I feel like she could do hats. She could do jewelry. I love her style. So I would eat that up.
The thing about her is like, I feel like commercialism is like not her bag.
That's true.
But I think she, to your point, I think she can make a lot of money doing it. And I think if she like pitched it like, yo, this is from this farm in West Africa that is such and such, that like also gives back. It could be like an altruistic kind of thing that she's helping people out, right? Or that she's supporting other small businesses. Like, it could be that kind of angle. And I think that'd be really smart for her.
It's not the commercial route. It's not like, you know, you can go to Nordstrom and get her stuff. It's like you go to Afropunk and like a line of jewelry is there on a table that's like brought to you by Lauren Hill and some like artisan crafts person, and they only made like 100 of these earrings or something like that. You know, like small run, artisan, handmade, funky, you know, sourced. Like, give us a documentary of Lauren going to South Africa and finding the jewels for the necklace that she's going to sell you. Like, to your point, making it feel authentic to her and not commercial, I think would be key. But again, I think that you honed in on something that I think is a big part of why she's kind of moved away from the spotlight, is because she doesn't like that part of the industry, that part of the business.
Yeah. And I also like, and this leads to my fix, I also don't know that she works well with other people. Like, I really think that like art is collaborative. No matter, even if you write a whole fucking song, let's use your, you know, write a check song. You wrote a whole fucking song in your apartment by yourself. Yeah. You still put it on Al Gore's internet, right?
Yes.
You still
Blue Ivy's internet, and not Al Gore.
Excuse me, Blue Ivy. Yes. Thank you. Sorry, we've upgraded. We're in a new generation. Thank you so much. But you've like, the internet is not yours. You put it on Instagram, which is owned by Meta, right? So like, in that way, I would say it's collaborative. You can't do it alone. Mm-hmm. And Lauren might need to be doing something by herself. And in that sense, I think she should start a church. Because clearly, honestly, I'm dead ass. I am not joking with you.
I know you are, but like, the levels of shade, it's very funny. It's smart, but it's shady.
I mean, she is all about God. She's preaching. You know, like, listen, she can preach. She can sing. Mm-hmm. You know, she can do all the praise she wants. She is the soul voice of the church. She can be the preacher. I, you know, listen, many black people artists did it. I think James Brown was a preacher.
Yeah.
Little Richard was a preacher.
Yeah, but you know what makes me think of Kanye has a church, and that shit is weird. That's why I don't like it. I don't want her to go down that path.
It's absolutely going to be weird, because let's be honest, Lauren is weird, right? Yes. Mm-hmm. But I do think, like, you know, it kind of plays into her God complex. She wants to be the sole voice who's like delivering a message, and she could, you know, I don't know what that church might be. It feels like it might get a little culty to me. Mm-hmm. But she could be the sole voice, and Lauren, you know, you ain't got to pay no taxes. Now that's shade. Now that's shade.
I was going to say, if you need a name for your church, how about On the Hill? You know what I mean?
I was going to say Miss Hills.
But Miss Hill on the Hill, I feel like something about the hill feels like, you know, you're walking up to, you know, meet God or talk to him or something like that. I could see the vision. But I also
the hilltop. Yeah, I think that's so.
Oh, God. Yeah, well, you know, Lauren, if you're listening, take this and do what you will with it. But class, we want to know, Lauren Hill, did we fix it? What do you think it would take for her to have a comeback? Let us know over on Instagram at FixItPod or email us, letmefixitpod@gmail.com.
And now it's time for everyone's favorite segment, The Glow Up, where we give props to those who turn themselves around without our help. Francesca, please do the honors.
Okay, so my glow up goes to book clubs. Millennials and Gen Z are bringing book clubs back as a way to socialize. According to Eventbrite, book club listing events grew 24% in the United States in 2023, and Meetup saw a 10% increase in book club listings. And I think one of the big reasons, Delon, is Book Talk, which is people on TikTok reviewing books, sharing the books that they're reading, starting book reading challenges. Authors have seen huge sale boost from going viral on BookTok, and a number of bookstores now have a special section dedicated to BookTok favorites. I mean, TikTok.
Oh my God. It is so, there's so much in the app. I said this to you, Francesca. I feel like every time I go to TikTok, I'm like, what is, there's so many things, hashtags and things and follow this. And I'm like, for you page. Whoa.
It's wild.
It is so much.
It's wild. So much. If you can blow up on TikTok, it can change your entire career. And what's happening now is a lot of these niche book clubs are starting, like having these book club events, queer book clubs, and then people are calling silent book clubs, where people gather in public spaces like bars, cafes, bookstores, and libraries, and just read. They're not even talking to each other.
Wow.
They're just all reading at the same time. Also, a lot of independent bookstores have really sprung up. In the wake of the pandemic, these bookstores are popping up everywhere. More than 250 independent shops opened in 2022. Barnes & Noble's is also having a massive comeback. The chain expanded.
I thought she was dead.
I thought she was too. But, you know, Book Talk has everybody out here like, we need books. We need the books, and we need them now.
Well, I wonder if this is kind of a pushback to like all of the book banning. I mean, this is me conflating things as I want to do, but there's been so much book banning and like trying to take away the knowledge from us that I wonder if it's like, you know, no, we need to read.
Yeah. And to your point about the book bannings, a number of libraries are closing all over the country. So it does seem like the silver lining, as frustrating as the book bannings and the library closings are, people still want to read. There's still a thirst for knowledge. In 2024, Barnes & Noble plans on opening 50 more stores. They opened 30 new stores last year.
Wow.
Books are back. All right, Dawn, what's your glow up this week?
Yeah, so my glow up might be a little weird, but it goes to Little Richard, who was one of the pioneers of rock and roll, you know, eccentric character himself, has a whole journey of, you know, being a queer artist that didn't say he was queer, but then coming out as queer, but then going back in the closet and finding God and then coming back out of the closet. Like, such a crazy life. The reason I'm giving it to Little Richard is I don't think that we've given him his due in terms of being a pioneer of such a huge musical genre.
Yeah.
There are three Black artists that I can't think of right now, but Little Richard is one of them that is really credited with creating rock and roll.
Yeah.
But Little Richard, especially in the latter part of his life, was telling everybody, I am the pioneer. I am everything. All of you came after me. I mean, literally, he was influenced. He influenced the Rolling Stones, the Beatles.
Yep.
The Rolling Stones opened for him on his first tour in the UK. There's a documentary by Magnolia Films that just came out that, like, really put this in my brain hole, but it also like really made me kind of upset that like what happens to a lot of artists, and a lot of artists tend to be queer artists, but a lot of artists is that you get your recognition posthumously, right? Yeah. People go, oh, you know what? Richard created this and he created that and he created that.
Tell them why they're here.
And pay them, right?
Yes.
And you know, the theme of this episode was, you know, Lauren and the music industry and people taking advantage of her. And like Little Richard, like Tutti Frutti, like that, he didn't own that. He recorded that and people took that and he barely made money on that. He made no royalties on that.
He created like his own sound, like even just like him being like, wah, blah, 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 blah. Like he just was making things up that have become iconic staples of music. And it's wild to think that he was not getting the financial credit.
Yeah, and him banging on the piano the way he was, like, it was new and exciting. And again, he's such a pioneer. So I just want to give him space and go, I'm glad we're giving you your flowers now, Richard, even though, you know, you're not with us anymore. Because you deserved more. But I'm glad we're talking about him now. So I want to put him on blast.
Check out that documentary. My barber was playing it while I was getting my haircut. And then the haircut finished and I was like, can I stay and watch? Because I don't want to finish. It was so eye-opening. It was really wonderful.
It's so good. And I love a documentary. And there are a lot of them coming out about Black artists, which I really am enjoying. Because like we need to tell that history, you know. So, class, you know we want to hear from you. How many hours are you willing to wait for a performance of Lauryn Hill? 2, 3? Or maybe you'd like to suggest a TV show, a celeb, or brand we should fix in a future episode. Please hit us up on Instagram @FixItPod or email us at letmefixitpod@gmail.com.
And do not forget, we have a YouTube channel where you can look at our beautiful faces as you listen to the episode, youtube.com/@@fixitpod. And if you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to give us a rating on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, or your favorite podcast app.
I am DeLon.
And I'm Francesca. And this was
Let Me Fix It. Guys, you know you're better.
Watch out.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.